that mission should be designed and developed for the SEAL operators that would execute the operation. PLO stood for Platoon Leader's Order, a term used by SEALs since the Vietnam era. The rest of the U.S. military called it an Operations Order, or OPORD. After 9/11, joint operations in close coordination with U.S. Army, Marines, and Air Force through the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq caused SEALs to adopt the OPORD term. But by whatever name, it meant the same thing, a mission brief. This brief laid out the specific details of who, what, when, where, why, and how a combat operation would be conducted. The OPOR was prepared for and given to the SEAL operators and supporting assets who were to participate in an operation. It was supposed to allow every member of a SEAL element and other U.S. or foreign allied forces involved to understand the overall plan, their role in the plan, what to do when things went wrong, and how to contact help if the worst-case scenario took place. A good plan was critical to mission accomplishment, and briefing that plan to the troops enabled effective execution of the plan. Without successful execution, the best-laid plans were worthless. The trouble was, as a new SEAL officer in training, the PLO is for the boys concept simply hadn't held true. In training scenarios I had encountered, the PLO or OPORD brief had, in reality, always seemed to be about impressing the instructors or the senior officer in the room with our PowerPoint prowess. Through more than a year and a half of training in the SEAL pipeline, there were always SEAL instructors and or SEAL officers sitting in on the brief to evaluate. Without fail, the instructor staff would tear apart our plan and in particular our brief, hitting every detail. Their criticism focused mostly on the presentation slides themselves, with one clear message: there needed to be more slides, more graphs, more timelines, more charts, more phase diagrams, more imagery, more everything. It was humbling, but also overwhelming. As a junior officer in a SEAL platoon, my job was to oversee the plan and put together the OPOR brief to best capture the tactical plan developed by our SEAL chief, a number of key players within the platoon, and me. I would compile all the information together into a Microsoft PowerPoint presentation, and along with those key players, deliver it to the operators in the SEAL platoon and troop that would execute the mission. While the junior SEAL operators were preparing gear and the SEAL chiefs and leading petty officers were debating tactics and figuring out who was in charge of what portion of the mission, the officers worked on PowerPoint slides to assemble all this information into a brief. Military mission planning seemed daunting. There were so many moving pieces and parts to every combat operation, so many variables. The OPOR briefing format we were given was developed for a 96-hour planning cycle. It assumed we would have at least 4 days to prepare for a combat mission. The format consisted of more than 70 PowerPoint slides. In actual practice, we had only a few hours to plan for our training exercises, so the long and detailed format invariably left us far too little time. We wasted most of our efforts building slides and neglected important pieces of the plan. On my first deployment as a SEAL officer, we deployed to Baghdad, Iraq. The war in Iraq at that time thrust many U.S. military units into heavy combat, but I didn't get to experience the flood of combat operations as I'd hoped. We spent most of our time providing security for one of the top officials of the interim Iraqi government, and I spent most of my time in the Tactical Operations Center sitting at a desk making phone calls, monitoring our team via radio, and building PowerPoint slides. As SEAL officers, we were so inundated with PowerPoint that some officers had patches made for their uniforms to jokingly designate themselves PowerPoint Rangers 3,000 hours. It was typical SEAL humor to laugh at the misery. Luckily, my executive officer saw the importance of getting his young leaders into combat, and he tasked me to lead a small element of SEALs in a series of sniper missions supporting a battalion of the historic Big Red One, the U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division, in the city of Samarra. We were able to make a difference and lower the number of attacks on U.S. Army soldiers. But after 3 weeks, we only had one confirmed kill on an enemy fighter and a couple more probable kills. We coordinated with the Army units, but didn't really conduct any detailed planning or briefing. If anything, I learned some bad habits when it came to planning. When I joined Task Unit Bruiser at SEAL Team 3 and became platoon commander for Charlie Platoon, I began working for Jocko. He expected me and my key leaders in Charlie Platoon to utilize the standard planning process used by small units in the rest of the military. He expected us to own it, extreme ownership. Through a six-month-long training workup, Task Unit Bruiser learned to work together as a team across the full spectrum of SEAL operations in a host of different environments. At the end of every block of training, the final phase culminated in a series of field training exercises, or FTXs. These were full-scale training missions that required us to put together a plan, brief that plan to our troops, and then execute. Our performance in training would dictate where we would be sent on deployment. Of the three SEAL task units at our team, not everyone would deploy to fight in Iraq. Our team had to allocate one task unit for what would be a largely non-combat deployment to the Philippines. Task Unit Bruiser, like the other task units, wanted to fight to put our skills to use where we could make a difference. It was a competition to excel in training so that we could be chosen by the command to deploy to Iraq. By the time we were in our final block of training, a decision of who would go where was imminent. Our SEAL Team Commanding Officer, or CO, and Operations Master Chief informed us that they would visit us in Task Unit Bruiser to observe our brief for the final FTX. We knew that in order for us to be chosen, we had to knock this one out of the park. "No pressure," said Jocko to the other SEAL platoon commander and me with a sarcastic smile. "Whether or not we get the chance of a lifetime to deploy to the war in Iraq all depends on whether you two can pull off a good brief." Frantically, we put each of our platoon's key leaders to work developing a plan for the FTX mission, and we began building the brief. But as we pieced it together, it was clear our brief was lacking in many areas. It was heavy on PowerPoint slides, overly complex, and not explicitly clear on the different pieces and parts of the execution. We were running out of time. "We're going to fail," insisted the other platoon commander to Jocko and me. Frankly, I wasn't a whole lot more confident. "Listen," said Jocko, "here's what I want you to do. Forget about all this crazy PowerPoint. I want this plan to be clear to everyone that is actually in your platoon. I'm not worried about the CO or the Master Chief. Brief it to your guys, the troops who will be executing the mission." "The true test for a good brief," Jocko continued, "is not whether the senior officers are impressed. It's whether or not the troops who are going to execute the operation actually understand it. Everything else is bullshit. Does any of that complex crap help one of your SEAL machine gunners understand what he needs to do and the overall plan for what will happen on this operation?" "No," I responded. "Far from it," Jocko continued. "In fact, it's confusing to them. You need to brief so that the most junior man can fully understand the operation, the lowest common denominator. That's what a brief is, and that is what I want you to do. If there is some flack over this from the CO, don't worry, I will take it." With this guidance, we revamped our op board presentations. We simplified and cut down the number of PowerPoint slides and focused on the most important pieces of the plan, which would give our troops a chance to ask questions, to clarify anything that wasn't understood. We hung maps on the walls, the same ones that we would carry in the field, and referenced them so that everyone was familiar. We incorporated hand sketches and manning lists on dry erase boards. We had the troops brief the parts they were planning or leading and ask them questions during the process to ensure their piece of the plan was clear and that they understood it fully. That was something we never had time for when we were bogged down creating massive PowerPoint briefs with 100 slides. Most importantly, Jocko explained to us that as leaders, we must not get dragged into the details, but instead remain focused on the bigger picture. "The most important part of the brief," said Jocko, "is to explain your commander's intent. When everyone participating in an operation knows and understands the purpose and end state of the mission, they can theoretically act without further guidance." This was a completely different mindset for us, and we ran with it. While Jocko pushed us to focus on commander's intent and the broader plan, he encouraged us to let the junior leaders in the platoon sort out and plan the details. "As a leader, if you are down in the weeds planning the details with your guys," said Jocko, "you will have the same perspective as them, which adds little value. But if you let them plan the details, it allows them to own their piece of the plan. And it allows you to stand back and see everything with a different perspective, which adds tremendous value. You can then see the plan from a greater distance, a higher altitude, and you will see more. As a result, you will catch mistakes and discover aspects of the plan that need to be tightened up, which enables you to look like a tactical genius just because you have a broader view." I realized this was exactly what Jocko did to us all the time. It was a race against time, but just before the CO and Master Chief arrived, our platoons finished their portions of the plan and we walked through them. As Jocko had predicted, we noticed things they didn't see. With some minor adjustments, we filled in the holes. We ran through the plan with Jocko one last time, rehearsed the presentations, tightened up a few things, and made final adjustments. Already, our confidence had grown because we were briefing what we truly knew and understood, and what we knew our platoon members also completely understood. Finally, our briefs were ready. When the CO and Master Chief arrived, they sat in the back of the room as we presented our op ward brief to the platoons. The other platoon commander and I gave an overview of the mission, and then our key leaders got up and briefed the details. We pulled everyone out of their seats and gathered them around the map to walk through where we were going. We talked through each phase of the mission in plain English so that everyone understood. We stopped at key points and asked questions of the troops to ensure they were absorbing the information. We even had individual platoon members brief back portions of the plan to us to verify they had a clear understanding and could run the mission themselves if needed. When something wasn't completely clear, our SEAL operators asked for clarification, which enabled us to feel confident they understood and were taking ownership of their role. When the brief concluded, this time, much to our surprise, the CO and Master Chief gave us credit for a solid brief and delivery. The CO said that of all the mission briefings he had listened to during the workup, these were the ones he understood most clearly. We still had work to do to further enhance and refine our mission planning skills, but we had turned the corner by understanding what mission planning and briefing was all about. Shortly thereafter, we received word that Task Unit Bruiser had been chosen to deploy to Iraq. It was the news we had been waiting for. That set us on a path that led a few months later to the city of Ar-Ramadi and through some of the toughest sustained urban combat in the history of the SEAL teams. In that challenging environment, detailed mission planning and briefing played a critical role in our success. We planned and briefed hundreds of combat operations in Task Unit Bruiser and executed them with precision. We participated in the mission plans and op-ward briefs with U.S. Army and Marines for dozens of large-scale battalion and brigade-size operations, some involving as many as 1,000 U.S. soldiers and Marines on the ground and nearly 100 tanks and armored vehicles. We owned our planning process. After each combat operation, we pulled our platoon together and talked through the details in a post-operational debrief. In a concise and to-the-point format, we analyzed what had worked and what hadn't, how we might refine our standard operating procedures, and how we could do it better. As a result, we constantly learned and grew more effective. That ensured we performed at the highest levels and enabled our success. In such a dangerous environment, it helped us maintain an edge and allowed us to effectively mitigate some risks, which meant more of our guys came home alive. Mission planning played an integral role in our success on the battlefield. The right process mattered. Disciplined planning procedures mattered. Without them, we would have never been successful. With that lengthy story of how I learned to properly plan as a SEAL leader, I addressed how the emerging markets VP and his regional manager could certainly benefit from such a system. You could use a planning procedure like we had, I told them. You should develop a standard process with terminology and planning method that are interchangeable and can be utilized across all elements within your team and within the company. That is exactly what we need, said the emerging markets VP. We need to capture our standard operating procedures for planning. We need a process that is repeatable. Can you teach this to my team? Absolutely, I said. Over the next few weeks, I sent a workbook to the emerging markets VP, his regional manager, and their senior staff. The workbook provided an overview of the military mission planning process we had used with some adaptation to the business world. We scheduled several conference calls in which I explained our process and why. The VP and his leadership team adapted this planning process to the challenges of their industry. Once they had a good understanding of the planning framework, we scheduled a presentation to key leaders with the emerging markets team. I flew out and presented the foundational knowledge of the planning process from the workbook in detail. We then gave the team a planning exercise using a realistic future operation similar to those they routinely encountered. The regional manager and I guided the team as they put together the plan. After an hour or so, they had built the basics of their plan into a brief to present to us, just as a SEAL platoon or task unit would present an op-ward. During the presentation, the regional manager and I analyzed their plan. Afterward, we debriefed them on their plan's strengths and weaknesses talked about where it was ambiguous and needed clarification, and brought up points that had been glossed over or neglected and why they were important. I instructed them to revise the plan with those thoughts in mind, under the tutelage of their regional manager. A month later, I placed a phone call to the regional manager to track the team's progress. She sent me a copy of their latest detailed plan. "I like the plan you sent," I told her. "It has improved much from the first attempt." "Yes," the regional manager agreed. "And we just executed on that plan, and it went well. As a result of the planning, the team was able to anticipate and address some contingencies. Before, such contingencies would have cost us business and a decent loss in revenue. But now, with our planning process in place, we were prepared and the team knew how to respond. As a result, we continue to generate revenue." "Great," I said. "With everyone understanding my commander's intent," said the regional manager, "the team is able to be more decisive on the front lines. They can support the mission without having to run every question up the chain of command. Our ability to plan is enabling us to better execute and win." Chapter 10, Leading Up and Down the Chain of Command. Leif Babin. Camp Mark Lee, Ramadi, Iraq. Leading down the chain of command. The night sky suddenly lit up like a laser show at a rock concert. Some distance across the river, U.S. security positions in the heart of Ramadi were under attack. Almost immediately, American sentries returned fire with a massive barrage from heavy machine guns, sending their own streaks of brilliant orange-red tracers back at enemy positions. Seconds passed before the distant rattle and boom of machine gun fire, mixed with intermittent explosions, reached us. As any military veteran knew, tracers were generally placed every fifth round in belt-fed machine guns, which meant that there was a hell of a lot of hot lead flying around in the darkness that we couldn't see. The distant firefight continued for some time. As Jocko and I watched, flaming streaks from the engines of an unseen U.S. attack aircraft, likely a Marine F-18 Hornet, appeared in the sky over the distant fight. Light flashed as a missile ignited off the wing, streaked across the sky, and exploded in a brilliant burst of light. Hopefully, they had smoked the enemy without any American casualties. It was all quite a show, but here in Ramadi, it was nothing out of the ordinary. It had been a still and clear evening until the distant firefight lit up the night. The baking temperatures of the Iraqi summertime heat had recently given way to a tolerable, cooler fall. Jocko and I sat on the dusty rooftop of the large three-story concrete building that served as our tactical operations center on the base that had been our home, Camp Mark Lee. Our SEAL task unit had been in Ramadi for nearly 6 months. Soon, we were scheduled to return to the States. With no combat operations pending that evening, Jocko and I had a rare moment to reflect as we looked across the peaceful, dark waters of the Euphrates River and the lights of Ramadi on the far bank and beyond. We reminisced about the combat operations our task unit had participated in and all that had happened here. Task Unit Bruiser had conducted hundreds of operations and endured many an onslaught from enemy attacks like the one we just witnessed. We had been in dozens of firefights, had thousands of rounds shot at us, shot back thousands of our own, and frequently called in fire support from U.S. tanks or aircraft. Our SEALs had done substantial damage to the enemy. Witnessing the triumph of success, we knew we had made a difference, but we also endured extraordinary loss. 2 months earlier, in the midst of a huge battle for the heart of the city, we had lost Mark Lee, the first SEAL killed in action in the Iraq War, and the man in whose honor we named the camp. Mark's death was devastating. It left a hole that could never be filled. The same day we lost Mark, another beloved Charlie Platoon SEAL, Ryan Job, had been hit in the face by an enemy sniper round. Ryan lost an eye and took substantial damage to his face. But we waited for hopeful news from the doctors that sight would return in his remaining eye. 3 weeks later, as he recovered in a hospital in Germany, those hopes were dashed when we learned Ryan would never see again. He was blind. This news was absolutely crushing. Then, just as our deployment came to a close, a task unit bruiser SEAL in Delta Platoon, Mike Mansour, was out on what would likely have been his last combat operation before returning home. When an enemy hand grenade was tossed into Delta Platoon's position, Mike dove on top of that grenade, shielding his teammates around him from the bulk of the blast and sacrificing himself for them. Each of these fallen SEALs were beloved teammates, friends, and brothers. We would forever mourn their loss. On the rooftop that night, as Jocko and I talked about all we had been a part of in Ramadi, we knew Task Unit Bruiser had fulfilled a key role in the U.S. Army Ready First Brigade's strategy that successfully wrested control of key Ramadi neighborhoods from the insurgents. After months of effort and countless firefights, U.S. forces and their Iraqi Army partner forces now had a presence where they previously had none. They could now secure the populace from the savage insurgents who had long controlled most of the city. This and the foresight of the Ready First Brigade's leadership set the conditions for tribal sheikhs to successfully rise up against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and unite with U.S. forces in what would become the Anbar Awakening. Task Unit Bruiser was proud to have played a role in the Ready First Brigade's success. We had killed hundreds of insurgent fighters, helped to eliminate many of their safe havens, and deeply disrupted their freedom of movement. Now, with the Ready First combat outposts in place throughout much of the city, the enemy no longer exercised complete control over many neighborhoods of Ramadi. But the distant firefight we had just witnessed from the rooftop was a reminder that the enemy was still capable, deadly, and determined to fight back for control of the city. What lasting impact did we truly have here, I wondered. Soon afterward, we turned over our operations to the next SEAL task unit that took our place. Our time in Ramadi came to an end as the last of us from Task Unit Bruiser boarded a big U.S. Air Force C-17 cargo aircraft for the flight home. Once back stateside, it was quite a transition from the intense violence in the bloody streets of Ramadi to the peace and tranquility of San Diego, California. For many of us, it was an emotional return. After all the blood, sweat, and tears the Task Unit Bruiser and our brothers and sisters in arms and the U.S. Army and Marine Corps had spilled there, I felt torn. We had lost the first SEALs killed in action in the Iraq War. As a leader, nothing had prepared me for that monumental burden I must forever carry for not bringing all my guys home to their families. If only I could trade places with them. When Ryan got shot and Mark was killed, they were doing exactly what I had asked of them. I was in charge. I was responsible. My fellow platoon commander felt the same way about Mike Mansoor. I knew Jocko felt that burden for each man. Hearing American pundits and the media talking about all the blood and treasure spent in Iraq, I reacted with fury. To them, the casualty figures were just statistics, numbers on a page. To us, they were teammates and friends, brothers. Their families suffered the greatest hardship. These men were deeply missed and painfully mourned. Others had been seriously wounded, and some would never fully recover. Their lives, and those of their families and friends, would likewise never be the same. The true sacrifices endured by the troops who fought this war were far beyond anything that most Americans could comprehend. Within our own beloved SEAL community, we heard the mutterings of criticism about our operations from the armchair quarterbacks in the rear echelon, far from the battlefield. They clearly didn't understand what we had done and why. They didn't witness the impact of our operations or the difference we had made. With angry emotion, I wrestled with how best to professionally respond to those critics, particularly from senior officers with no real combat experience. Part of me wanted to punch them in the mouth, but a bigger part of me just wanted them to understand what we had accomplished and why. I knew that anyone who truly comprehended what Task Unit Bruiser had done and who understood the incredible victory the U.S. Army Ready First Brigade had achieved in Ramadi would respect not only the bravery and dedication of the troops, but also the strategic success, securing Ramadi and Anbar Province from the brink of disaster. It had been a monumental triumph for U.S. forces on one of the toughest battlefields anywhere, when many doubted we could win. The doubters have been proved wrong. Some within the SEAL community said we took too much risk, that our sniper operations were just playing whack-a-mole. Used to a paradigm of traditional special operations, they could not comprehend the adaptations we had made or the risk those adaptations held. nor did they understand the nature of counterinsurgency and the spectacular reversal toward peace and security that had been achieved. Some of the politicians and most senior military brass in Washington felt that killing bad guys only created more enemies, but they didn't have a clue. Our lethal operations were crucial to securing the populace. Each enemy fighter killed meant more U.S. soldiers and Marines came home alive. It meant more Iraqi soldiers and police lived to fight another day. And it meant more of Ramadi's civilian populace could live in a little less fear. No longer could the enemy ruthlessly torture, rape, and murder innocent civilians. Once the local people no longer feared the insurgents, they were willing to join with U.S. and Iraqi forces to defeat them. Shortly after Task Unit Bruisers returned to the United States in late October of 2006, Jocko was asked to build a presentation for the Chief of Naval Operations, the most senior admiral in the Navy, a member of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a direct advisor to the president. Jocko took a map of Ramadi and built an overlay that depicted the geographic areas that had been completely under enemy control, Al-Qaeda battle space, when we first arrived. These were areas that, when I arrived in Ramadi, the SEAL platoon commander, who had spent the previous 6 months there, pointed to and said to me, "Don't go in there. You will all get killed, and no one will even be able to reach you to get you out." From this map of Ramadi, Jocko built a PowerPoint slide that depicted how the Ready First combat team's seize, clear, hold, build strategy systematically, through months of effort, established a permanent presence in the enemy-held neighborhoods and pushed out the enemy fighters. U.S. forces and the Iraqi forces with them demonstrated to the people of Ramadi that we were now the strongest side. As a result, the local populace joined us and turned against the insurgents who had terrorized them. The slide depicted how Task Unit Bruiser SEALs had been the lead element for virtually every major operation to build a combat outpost in enemy territory and take those neighborhoods back. When Jocko showed me the slide he had built, it all came together for me for the first time. Though I had been directly involved in the planning of almost all of these missions, had been on the ground leading a team of operators, coordinated with the other elements on the battlefield, and had written detailed reports of what had happened after each mission, I still had not linked them all together, nor considered the strategic impact they had had. But now, Jocko's brief captured in simple terms all that had been accomplished in the Battle of Ramadi. This was a striking realization. I was Charlie Platoon Commander, second in seniority only to Jocko and Task Unit Bruiser, and yet, immersed in the details of the tactical operations, I had not fully appreciated or understood how these operations so directly contributed to the strategic mission with spectacular results beyond anyone's wildest dreams. "Damn," I said to Jocko, "I never really put it all together like that before." This one slide made it immediately clear why we had done what we had done. While this knowledge could never ease the pain endured by the loss of incredible SEAL friends and teammates, it certainly helped to put in perspective why we had taken such risk and what had been accomplished. As platoon commander, I had detailed insight into the planning and coordination with the Army and Marine battalions and companies that was far beyond most of the SEAL operators in my platoon. Yet, if I didn't fully comprehend or appreciate the strategic impact of what had been done, how could I expect my frontline troops, my junior SEAL operators not in a leadership role, to get it? The answer, I couldn't. For a young SEAL shooter with a very limited role in the planning process, who was out working on his weapons and gear, conducting maintenance on our vehicles, or building demolition charges for the breacher, he walked into our mission briefs wondering, "What are we doing next?" He had no context for why we were doing the operation or how the next tactical mission fit into the bigger picture of stabilizing and securing Ramadi. I realize now that as their leader, I had failed to explain it to them. Clearly, there was some level of strategic perspective and comprehension that would only come with time and reflection. But I could have done a far better job as a leader to understand for myself the strategic impact of our operations and pass this insight to my troops. When Jocko saw my reaction to the slide and the presentation he had built, he too realized that he should have more fully detailed the strategic impact of what we were doing and why. It was a realization for him that even when a leader thinks his troops understand the bigger picture, they very often have difficulty connecting the dots between the tactical mission they are immersed in with a greater overarching goal. Looking back on Task Unit Bruiser's deployment to Ramadi, I realized that the SEALs in Charlie Platoon, who suffered the worst combat fatigue, whose attitudes grew progressively more negative as the months of heavy combat wore on, who most questioned the level of risk we were taking on operations, they all had the least ownership of the planning for each operation. Conversely, the SEAL operators who remained focused and positive, who believed in what we were doing, and who were eager to continue and would have stayed on beyond our six-month deployment if they could, they all had some ownership of the planning process in each operation, even if they only controlled a small piece of the plan, the route into or out of a target, the breach scene on an entry door, coordination with supporting aircraft, managing an assault force of Iraqi soldiers. Those SEAL operators still better understood the mission, the detailed steps taken to mitigate those risks we could control, the commander's intent behind why we were conducting that specific operation. The SEALs with little or no ownership were somewhat in the dark. As a result, they had a harder time understanding why we were taking the risks we were taking and what specific impact we had in the campaign to liberate Ramadi. Looking back, one of the greatest lessons learned for me was that I could have done a far better job of leading down the chain of command. I should have given greater ownership of plans to the troops, especially those who were negative and weren't fully committed to the mission. I should have taken the time to better understand how what we were doing contributed to the strategic mission. I should have asked those questions to Jocko and on up my chain of command. I should have put together a routine strategic overview brief and regularly delivered this to Charlie Platoon's operators so that they could understand what we had accomplished and how our missions furthered the strategic goals of stabilizing Ramadi and securing the populace. With the physical hardship of operating in Iraqi summertime heat reaching 117 degrees Fahrenheit, carrying heavy loads of gear, and routinely engaging in fierce firefights with enemy forces, the SEAL operators in Charlie Platoon needed greater context to understand why that was necessary. Seeing the Ramadi overview slide that Jocko had built, I now understood what we had done and, more important, understood what leading down the chain of command was all about. It was a hard lesson to learn, but one I will never forget. Principle: leading down the chain. Any good leader is immersed in the planning and execution of tasks, projects, and operations to move the team toward a strategic goal. Such leaders possess insight into the bigger picture and why specific tasks need to be accomplished. This information does not automatically translate to subordinate leaders and the frontline troops. Junior members of the team, the tactical level operators, are rightly focused on their specific jobs. They must be in order to accomplish the tactical mission. They do not need the full knowledge and insight of their senior leaders, nor do the senior leaders need the intricate understanding of the tactical level operators' jobs. Still, it is critical that each have an understanding of the other's role, and it is paramount that senior leaders explain to their junior leaders and troops executing the mission how their role contributes to big picture success. This is not intuitive and never as obvious to the rank and file employees as leaders might assume. Leaders must routinely communicate with their team members to help them understand their role in the overall mission. Frontline leaders and troops can then connect the dots between what they do every day, the day-to-day operations, and how that impacts the company's strategic goals. This understanding helps the team members prioritize their efforts in a rapidly changing dynamic environment. That is leading down the chain of command. It requires regularly stepping out of the office and personally engaging in face-to-face conversations with direct reports and observing the frontline troops in action to understand their particular challenges and read them into the commander's intent. This enables the team to understand why they are doing what they are doing, which facilitates decentralized command. As a leader employing extreme ownership, if your team isn't doing what you need them to do, you first have to look at yourself. Rather than blame them for not seeing the strategic picture, you must figure out a way to better communicate it to them in terms that are simple, clear, and concise so that they understand. This is what leading down the chain of command is all about. Camp Mark Lee, Ramadi, Iraq, leading up the chain of command. "You've got to be kidding me," I shouted as I burst into Jocko's office inside the talk. I was fuming. "Are they serious?" Our talk was located in a large three-story building on the bank of the Euphrates River, which had previously housed some of Saddam Hussein's senior military brass before the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Now, the once elaborate building was battered and worse for wear. It was the centerpiece of our SEAL camp, just beyond the large U.S. forward operating base of Camp Ramadi at the edge of the war-torn city. Invading armies had camped along this very riverbank for millennia. Babylonians, Assyrians, Persians, Greeks, Arabs, Ottoman Turks, and British troops. Now, American forces, including Navy SEALs and support personnel of Task Unit Bruiser, were here for a time. I was furious and venting my frustration at Jocko. Unbelievable. How do they expect us to actually plan our operations when they are bombarding us with ludicrous questions? I asked. Jocko had just forwarded me an email from our higher headquarters staff, led by our SEAL team's commanding officer, or CO. The email in question asked for clarification on an upcoming operation that Charlie Platoon planned to execute in the next few hours. As one of two platoon commanders in Task Unit Bruiser, I was Jocko's direct report, his immediate subordinate. Jocko reported directly to the CO, often through the CO's staff, who had sent the email. While Task Unit Bruiser was located in Ramadi, the CO and his staff were some 30 miles to the east in Fallujah, a city that had been cleaned up by the massive U.S. Marine offensive in 2004. Now, 2 years later, Fallujah remained fairly stable. It was a far different environment than the constant violence of Ramadi. Our operational plans required the CO's approval and on up the chain of command to the next level. The CO and his staff also provided many of the resources and support we needed to execute our missions in Ramadi. "What's the issue?" Jocko asked me, seeing that I was fired up. "The email?" He, too, was frustrated with the frequent questions and scrutiny. "Yes, the email," I replied. "Every little thing we do, they don't get." The oft-blamed they, in this case, was anyone outside of my immediate group of Charlie Platoon and Task Unit Bruiser. Jocko laughed. "I know you're frustrated," he said, "but I'm frustrated, too." I cut him off. "It's actually insane. We are busting our butts, risking our lives, and kicking some serious ass on the toughest battlefield in Iraq, and I have to answer idiotic questions like whether we have a QRF lined up." The QRF, or Quick Reaction Force, consisted of U.S. soldiers or Marines who would respond with armored vehicles, a couple of dozen troops, and heavy firepower when our SEALs got into a serious bind and were pinned down by enemy forces. Many of us in Task Unit Bruiser had been to Iraq previously, and a few had seen some decent combat. On those previous deployments, activating the QRF was virtually unheard of. But here in Ramadi, it was a common occurrence. On any operation, at any time, we knew we could be attacked by an overwhelming number of enemy fighters and our position overrun. In just the first few months on the ground here, we, Charlie Platoon, and our brethren in Delta Platoon, activated our QRF more times than I could count. The email Jocko had just forwarded to me from our higher headquarters asked a series of questions that our CO wanted to know prior to approving our pending operation. One of the questions read, "Did you coordinate an appropriate QRF?" I found this question almost an insult. Do they really think we would do any type of operation whatsoever here without a significant QRF package fully coordinated and on standby? I asked. "We even set up QRFs for our administrative convoys. This is Ramadi. Going out there without a QRF would be suicide." Jocko smiled. Over the previous weeks, he had vented similar frustration to me, probably more so than he should have. We would privately laugh at some of the questions that flowed from our higher headquarters. On one recent operation Charlie Platoon had planned, we were asked whether mortars were a danger for us. Mortars, with up to 20 pounds of high explosives cased in half-inch thick steel, fell from the sky and exploded with a tremendous concussion that threw lethal shrapnel in all directions. Often, enemy fighters fired mortars with impressive accuracy. Mortars were a danger for us on every operation, even while sitting on base. We selected buildings with thicker concrete walls that could provide some protection, and we tried never to be predictable so the enemy could not anticipate our next move. Besides that, mortars were a risk largely beyond our control. We had to focus our planning efforts on the risks we could control. Jocko had been every bit as frustrated with some of the questions and shared that with me. But since that time, he had come to the realization that the frustrations we had with our superiors were misguided. The CEO and his staff weren't bad guys out to make our lives harder and stifle our operations. They were good people trying to do their jobs the best they could and give us what we needed to accomplish our mission. But they weren't on the battlefield with us. They didn't fully understand the threats we dealt with on a daily basis and how hard we were working to mitigate every risk we possibly could. Still, this was combat, and there were inherent risks. In Ramadi, U.S. troops were killed or wounded almost every day. "We waste our time answering question after question," I said. "It takes effort away from our planning and preparation for the actual op itself. It's actually dangerous." Jocko knew I had a point, but he needed me to see beyond the immediate front-side focus of my team, Charlie Platoon, and understand the bigger picture. Jocko tried to calm me down and help me see our combat operations through the CO's eyes, from the perspective of his staff and the Special Operations Task Force. "The CO has to approve every mission. If we want to operate, we need to put him in his comfort zone so that he approves them and we can execute," Jocko said. "The more we give them, the more they ask for," I fired back. "They want an updated seating chart for our vehicles 5 minutes before the launch of every op, even though we have to make last-minute changes.